This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to your weekly podcast, Into England's Past. I'm Charles Rowe. You can subscribe through your usual podcast provider to get the latest episodes every Thursday. And please don't forget to give us a rating or review. Now, the first Duke of Wellington is famous for his victory over French Emperor Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. After returning, he became a celebrity, and when he was seen in public with an attractive woman, rumours would spread. While some of the Duke's early biographers portrayed him as a ladies' man, contemporary historians have started to question this, painting a more nuanced view of the Duke and his relationships. Joining me to uncover the truth, based on evidence she has uncovered at the Duke's former home, is Josephine Oxley, the keeper of the Wellington Collection at Apsley House. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Charles. It's lovely to be back.
So the last time we spoke to you was in episode 30 in person when we came to visit Apsley House. But for new listeners, can you remind us who the first Duke of Wellington was, what his real name was and what his background was and what he was like as a person?
Well, the first Duke of Wellington is probably known as the man who won the Battle of Waterloo and defeated Napoleon and brought an end to Napoleonic wars in Europe. He was probably our most famous British military leader. He was born Arthur Wellesley in Dublin in 1769. He came from a minor Irish aristocratic family. His father was the first Earl of Mornington, who actually died when he was 12. He was one of seven children and one of five sons, and not being the eldest really set the tone of his life, to be honest, because he had to struggle initially to get his career off the ground with much help from his eldest brother, Richard, who took over being head of the household after his father died. And then I think lesser known really is that once he was this very famous military leader at Waterloo, he had a long life after Waterloo, and he was a political figure. He was twice Prime Minister, and he was still very actively involved in lots of different social questions throughout his life and didn't die until 1852. So he had a very long life.
And he had popularity that sort of waxed and waned, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. So he was at the absolute top of his fame at Waterloo, European fame. Everybody knew who he was. He was hailed as the great national hero. But by about 1828, when he had entered politics and he was getting to be known as a political figure and he became Prime Minister, certainly during the Reform Acts in the early 1830s, his popularity definitely waned, so much so that, as you may remember, Charles, we discussed at Apsley House, the house was actually attacked by the mob on two occasions. He was so unpopular because he was anti-reform. And it wasn't really until he died in 1852 that his reputation was restored, really, with his great state funeral. And there was a great outpouring of national grief. So he certainly had his ups and downs throughout his life.
Yes, just remind us what the Reform Act was for people who weren't on episode 30.
The Reform Act was really about opening up the ability to vote. So previous to that, in the 1820s, the number of people that voted in the whole country was an incredibly small minority of people. And the Reform Act was really a political movement to open up franchise, to allow people to have a greater say in how they were governed and the rules that were made. And Wellington was an ultra-conservative and very much opposed to any kind of change that would rock the boat.
So a man with a colourful life and a complicated legacy in some respects.
Yeah, very, definitely. But generally, really remembered as this very famous military leader and a very romantic, heroic sort of figure.
Mm. And the big events tend to stick out in the general story, I tend to find. We're, of course, here to discuss the Duke's relationships with women rather than his military career. So how do you characterise his interest in women? And when did he start getting a reputation as a ladies' man? Did he start off as someone who was not so great with women, shall we say?
Well, the term ladies' man is quite difficult. And he was certainly a man who liked the company of women all through his life. But I think that the connotations of that term perhaps would lead us to believe that he was some kind of cad, you know, some kind of scoundrel. And he wasn't considered like that in his day. But like a lot of young men at the time, certainly at the end of the 18th century, had a lot of youthful flirtation, shall we say. And certainly his behaviour wasn't unusual for the kind of class that he came from. We don't know much about his early romantic life beyond a few little anecdotes about him. He was described by one family that he visited as a shallow, saucy stripling, and a certain Lady Aldborough, who took him in her carriage to a picnic outside Dublin, refused to return with him because he was so dull. Those were her words, so dull. However, he was also quite serious and ambitious because he was a younger son in a minor aristocratic family and he had to carve out a career for himself. But certainly in his early military career, some of his fellow officers commented on his penchant for flirting with married women. Now, this might literally mean flirting. It might just infer flirtation rather than anything sexual. We don't really know. I suppose it's Waterloo and post-Waterloo that we know more about the women that he was involved with because he was famous then. So the women that he was seen with were written about. And he definitely had a reputation in Paris after Waterloo. Had a whole coterie of ladies around him, and there were lots of rumours that he was the lover to all of them, which, you know, if you look at it sensibly, would have been fairly impossible for him to do anything else if he had been involved with them all sexually. But also the thing is, and we have to remember this, that throughout the 1820s and early 30s, when he did have a lot of female friends, there is absolutely no evidence of any sexual affairs, either with them or with anybody else. So unless it's incredibly well hidden, there's no evidence to say that he actually had a sexual relationship with these women. And I think I would characterise his relationships with women as complex and contradictory. Contradictory because he seems to have been quite distant and often quite cold and cutting to his own wife, which we'll talk about, but incredibly attentive and affectionate to many of his female friends. And complex because he had these really deep friendships with these women, and you wonder what he was looking for with these very affectionate friendships. But he famously said towards the end of his life that he had thought that no woman had ever loved him, which was rather an odd statement to make, but perhaps there was a little bit of truth in it, because although he'd had this absolute adoration from many women, perhaps he had felt throughout his life that he'd never actually had a proper loving relationship that he craved, and that involved a domestic loving relationship. He wanted to be at home, and perhaps his friendships with a lot of these other women involved him spending a lot of time with them, at their homes, with their families, with their children. And he seemed to have craved that domestic life, and he never felt that he had that.
Yes, I think we'll dig into that a little bit deeper with the next question. How did he meet his future wife?
Well, his future wife, who was Catherine Pakenham, she was always known as Kitty. She was the daughter of Lord Longford. Their families had mixed in the same society in Ireland. They probably knew each other as children. And then when Arthur comes back to Dublin, once he has been away with his mother, they'd lived in London, they'd lived in Brussels, he'd attended military academy in France. He comes back to Dublin. He's got a job as one of the ADCs to the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. He meets Kitty in society. They definitely develop quite a friendship. They enjoy balls and conversation and music. So that's how they got to know each other.
How long was the courtship then before they got married?
Well, the courtship was a bit unconventional because the courtship, we could say in reality, was more than 10 years. So they meet in the early 1790s. And in 1792, the young Arthur proposes to Kitty, goes to her father to ask for a hand in marriage, and he is rejected because Lord Longford does not feel that he's a fitting husband for his daughter Kitty, because he feels that he doesn't have great prospects, he's not very wealthy. But also, interestingly, something that comes out a little bit later via Kitty herself is that Lord Longford gives him quite a talking to and basically tells him to buck himself up and get a hold of things. And that he actually infers that he's too attached to gaiety and music. those were Kitty's words later. But he seems to have made up his mind that Kitty was the woman for him, in a very romantic sense. He then goes off to India, and he's away in India from 1796 until 1805. And within that time, Kitty, she'd been asked by her family not to write to him. He doesn't write to her. But in all that time, he doesn't make any other serious attachment to any other woman. And in about 1804, he hears about Kitty directly from a friend of hers called Mrs. Sparrow, who sort of acts as this kind of go-between. And then when he's thinking about returning home from India, suddenly he has this connection again with Kitty. And that's where the courtship takes up again, but it very rapidly turns into something else. So it's quite an unconventional kind of courtship, really.
Almost like absence makes the heart grow fonder. He maybe tapped into some sort of romantic ideal there.
Yeah,
I'm speculating, but, you know.
No, absolutely. And it is interesting. Obviously, perhaps his choices were limited in India, and he was mostly on campaign. It wasn't like he was sitting in Calcutta socialising with women. He was actually on campaign most of the time he was in India, with limited chance to meet women. But it's interesting that he does retain this affection for Kitty. And when he returns home, his thoughts are very much towards marriage, really. That's what he's thinking about.
So they've done all the courtship. When do they marry?
So they finally married in April 1806 in Dublin. And it's a rather bizarre renewal of the courtship. They hadn't seen each other for nearly 10 years. Kitty was by that time 33. He was 37. Her family thought that she was definitely going to be a spinster. She's considered quite old to marry. He's by now well known. He's wealthy. He's been promoted. He's much more of a acceptable prospect for anyone, actually. But he renews his liaison with Kitty. He writes to her eventually. She actually says, come and see me first. But in this very old-fashioned, honourable way, he sort of feels that he still has this engagement and commitment to Kitty, which he just renews. So he doesn't actually spend any time with her. And then he arrives in Dublin. And unfortunately, Kitty's much changed. You know, he'd left her 10 years earlier. She had changed. She'd been ill. She'd slightly lost her looks. So things had moved on, but he suddenly found that he couldn't really back out. So they go through with this marriage in Dublin, and it immediately starts to unravel.
Oh, dear. And is the Duke is the Duke already a Duke by this point?
No. The Duke's not a Duke until later on, until 1814. So, no, he doesn't have any titles at this point.
Okay, but he has sort of acquired some level of status, which would make him quite attractive to Kitty.
Yeah. He's a major general. He's incredibly wealthy after his campaigns in India. So, of course, her family are delighted that he comes back and pursues Kitty again. And they're, you know, by this time, her father has died, so it's her brother who's doing the deciding. And the Longfords are flattered that he's back, this famous soldier, wealthy and established, much more established than he was 10 years previously.
How long was the marriage?
Well, they got married in 1806 and Kitty died in 1831. But it's unfortunate because it wasn't a happy marriage. They quickly found that they were unsuited. And also the big factor here was that very shortly after they were married, just over a year, he was very much geared up to go back on campaign. So he was away for nearly 5 years fighting in Spain and Portugal, and he didn't return home. They'd managed to have two children before he left. He then left. Kitty was alone for 5 years. And when he returns from the Peninsular Wars in 1814, he is now a really celebrated hero. He had been made a duke. Their life had changed forever, really. And in some ways, it seemed that Kitty was sort of swept aside. And it's often said that she preferred a quiet life. But some of that must have been to do with the fact that she never heard much from him. So if she went out into society, people would immediately ask her, how was he? What was happening with him? Had she heard from him? And she didn't really know much more than anybody else because he really didn't write to her very much. She lived for his letters. She completely adored him, but he just gave her very few scraps while he was away in the Peninsula Wars. And then, of course, after Waterloo, from 1815, she had to contend with a whole band of admiring women. Women like Harriet Arbuthnot, Lady Salisbury, Lady Shelley, all those women that he had very deep relationships with and that he corresponded with and visited their homes and stayed with them, often without her. So the marriage was quite a disaster, really. And also Kitty sort of exacerbated it in some ways because she couldn't run the household. You know, you have to feel sorry for her when sometimes when you read his letters to her, he's very demanding, he's very exacting, he expects very high standards from her. She makes mistakes with money. She's too generous to some people. She gives money away. And he sometimes treats her like she is one of his officers. And he writes these letters that reprimand her about how she's running the household. It was a very difficult relationship.
Regarding the letter writing, was his correspondence with her as a younger man, before he acquired all this fame and status and rank, was his writing more lavish and romantic? Is there any evidence that he loved her more before he married her?
Well, yes, some of the early letters that we have between them. Obviously, most of those are going through Mrs. Sparrow, but they are loving, they're romantic in a way, I suppose, before they marry. But there doesn't seem to be much of that afterwards. The letters that he does write to Kitty are often quite factual. He inquires about the children, he does inquire about her. I don't want to give the impression that he's completely horrible and cold, because he's not. But often his letters, probably written in haste from his headquarters in Spain or Portugal or wherever he was, quite perfunctory, wanting to know details, often giving her quite a lot of instructions about what she needs to do. I would hardly class them as romantic, really.
No, that's interesting. I think perhaps speaking in defence of Arthur, the Duke, at that time, I think perhaps he was maybe just so caught up in his work. And he was leading men. He wasn't like a private who was thinking back to his sweetheart. Do you know what I mean?
I think there's a lot of truth in that, but also it wasn't unknown for officers' wives to be out there on campaign with their husbands. I mean, Wellington would never have countenanced that, and I don't think Kitty would have wanted that. So there is some truth in that. He was completely and utterly committed to what he was doing. And I think that that is part of the problem. There wasn't really room between 1806 and 1815 for much else apart from his military career. It would be really interesting, and I know that this is probably not a very good historical thing to do, but I often wonder what would have happened if he had married someone that he'd completely adored and been in love with. Would he have been away that often? Would he have had the same success in his military career? It's an interesting thing I often ponder. But again, you know, I think as well, we have to defend Kitty a little bit because she is very unsure of her situation all that time when he's away. She turns a blind eye often to rumours that are going around about his relationships with other women. And also later on after Waterloo, especially in the 1820s, when he's confiding to very good friends like Harriet Arbuthnot, who he's really close with, he tells Harriet Arbuthnot things about his marriage that really he shouldn't have. He confided in her and told her that he was a damn fool to have ever married Kitty. And he said that, this is a direct quote, at home he had not a creature to speak to for discussing political or important subjects. And he said that talking to the Duchess about these subjects was like talking Hebrew to her. So he did wrong, really, by admitting that to Harriet about his wife. So Harriet and other women that he knew intimately did sort of join in sometimes in the criticism of Kitty, and sometimes they were quite cutting towards her. So it's not surprising that she didn't want to go into society that often and be in the company of all these very brilliant and beautiful women who were often quite personal about her fashion sense, about the way she looked. So it was difficult on so many levels, it really was.
And that had a result on the Duke's interest in other women at the time, both intellectually and perhaps romantically. You talked about, obviously, his long periods of time away on active service. Did he have much time for other women during his military career?
Well, no, not really. And I don't think there's a great deal of real concrete evidence. I mean, certainly before he was married and he travelled to India, there's one or two sort of snippets of information. Some of his fellow officers said he had a bit of a penchant for married women. There was a little bit of gossip about a lady that he met, Mrs. Freeze. She was a wife of a fellow officer in India. And there were certainly ideas that their relationship had gone beyond flirtation. And in fact, there was even a thought that her little son, Arthur Freeze, was his son, which he wasn't. There were a lot of rumours while he was away in Spain and Portugal. But again, it's very hard to find anything concrete. But one can't imagine that he was away from home for 5 years without having some kind of interest in women, shall we say. However, there's one bit of very rare criticism from a lady called Lady Sarah Napier. And she's writing a letter and she's complaining about Wellington, which is really unusual. Her son was nearly killed at Corunna, the famous retreat to Corunna in the Peninsular Wars. And she says in a letter to a friend, "A commander-in-chief who publicly keeps mistresses at headquarters does not give all his attention to the care of the army." That's quite unusual to find that kind of blatant criticism of him.
Well, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned.
Oh, well, absolutely.
She's making a point there by the sounds of things.
She's absolutely making a point, yes. But as I say, quite a rare moment of criticism towards Wellington. But whatever Kitty heard, she never took anything on board. But I think that events kind of overtook their marriage in a way. So they married, he went away straight away, he became famous, he became titled and rich, he won Waterloo, and then we get onto that really interesting period post-Waterloo.
Yes, and I think this is where the evidence base builds a bit more because of the fact that things were being recorded more because of his fame. So how did the Duke's victory after Waterloo and the defeat of Napoleon and his renewed celebrity status change him, his life and his relationships?
Well, it's sort of twofold. One is that in Paris after Waterloo, there was this sort of frenzied excitement and the whole of English society suddenly arrives in Paris after Napoleon is defeated. You know, got to remember that a lot of these people, these aristocratic members of the English society, had not been in Paris for many years because they hadn't been able to because of the Napoleonic Wars. So there's great excitement and great excitement around Wellington, of course. And Mrs. Arbuthnot, Harriet Arbuthnot, who's a friend, she describes this frenzied excitement about the Duke as the new religion. He's surrounded by this coterie of adoring women, and they're all very attractive young women, many of them married. But of course, any woman he is now seen with in public is going to cause some kind of statement. There's going to be some kind of guessing game about what their relationship is about. And in Paris, he is very open about it because he is seen openly with women, entertaining them at the opera in his opera box, and not alone, often with lots of other people. He is accused of having relationships with Lady Frances Wedderburn Webster, Lady Charlotte Greville. Of course, Harriet is there. Another American lady, Marianne Patterson, who we'll talk about later, who he was pretty infatuated with. And then there are ladies like Madame Grassini, who's an Italian opera singer who had been Napoleon's mistress. He was very much connected to her. There's probably some truth in that. We know that he actually had a portrait of Madame Grassini hanging in his bedroom in Paris. So that probably tells you a little bit about it. Women rode out with him, went to balls with him. There was great parties. So it was a time when I think that really sort of cemented his reputation. But at the same time, he was always rather annoyed if people spoke about those women in the terms of him having affairs with them all. And I'm sure he didn't have affairs with them all, but I'm sure there was a lot of flirtation going on in that atmosphere in Paris.
Do you think it would have been really difficult to carry on and have a secret clandestine affair at that time, bearing in mind the morals of the time and his status? Or do you think that they would have just taken the risk?
I think personally that perhaps not at this point. I think there's probably some justification. But very soon after that, he is very aware of his reputation and his status. That goes back to what I said before, that if he was having lots of sexual affairs, they're incredibly well hidden. It's not that people didn't. Of course they did. And it was almost an accepted part of society. However, as we'll see, the kind of women that he was mostly involved with were women of his own social class, women that he knew their families. Often these women were a lot younger than him and he'd known them for many years. They might have been children and teenagers when he first met them. So by the time they're in their 20s and married, again, to men that he knows who are political allies, I think it's highly unlikely, but we'll come on to that because it's a very interesting question about Wellington and his status with all these women.
From my own point of view, I think it's very risky because of the reputation, because of the fact that he is married. Obviously, people had mistresses, but to be sort of gallivanting in public with these women and having affairs, I think would be quite a risk.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And also, what about the husbands of all these women?
Well, precisely, and a lot of the husbands were men that he knew. So I don't think that he would have got away with that in his social circle. Put his fame to one side, but a man who was in his mid-40s, going into the homes of friends and seducing their wives, I just don't think that would have happened at all. And that does become clear in the 1820s that there are a lot of these women that are just friends. They are platonic friends. But that isn't to discount that there were moments in his life when he did have sexual relationships with women. But they weren't often women of his own class. And that's an important point. And even when he returns from India and he's at that point where he's re-establishing his relationship with Kitty, we know that he is going to visit Harriet Wilson, who is a famous courtesan in London, because she famously writes about him in her memoirs. So he's not all innocent, but I think that after Waterloo, his reputation or his social standing is such that he can't risk too much gossip about his personal life.
Sure. I just want to pick up on your point about Harriet, the courtesan. Sounds slightly euphemistic. Tell us what a courtesan is, Josephine.
She was usually a young, attractive lady, of course, who often had her own house or place that men could come and meet her. She was subsidised, shall we say, politely, by her lovers. Harriet Wilson was quite a well-known courtesan and had quite a few aristocratic admirers. She wasn't an aristocrat herself. She came from fairly lowly beginnings. And she wasn't even supposed to be that beautiful, but she had something about her. And we know that the Duke was involved with her. And she did publish these memoirs, which are quite interesting and quite revealing. But again, how true they are, we don't know.
And they're one-sided.
And they're one-sided, of course, because the men that she wrote about never really responded to her memoirs about them. And this was much later on in the Duke's life. And of course, she was talking about him, you know, when he returned from India. And it was had been a long time ago. So yes, but courtesans were a fact of life and were often the way that aristocratic young men had their first sexual experiences, shall we say, because it would have been very rare for them to have their first sexual experiences with women of their own class. That would have been more unusual. So I just don't want to paint the picture of the Duke as being a pure angelic kind of figure, because I don't think he was. And I certainly think that he was away from his wife for so long on campaign, there must have been other women. But I think, you know, to go back to our previous point about the women that he knew and was friendly with, and the women that he spent years writing to and pouring out his heart. And I don't mean that in a romantic way. I mean talking to them about politics, about life in general, discussing everyone in their social set. Often the letters were very gossipy. Those were women that were friends, definitely.
Talking about gossip, would his exploits, his public persona, his appearances at various events with all these women who were married, would that have been reported widely in newspapers and periodicals of the time? And how would that compare to today's glossy magazines and tabloids?
Well, obviously not as explicit or as upfront as today's tabloid reporting, but there were gossip columns and the Duke was mentioned, and often it was very subtle. You know, it might just say the Duke arrived at such and such a party and he spoke to X, and it might mention a woman's name, and it would be sort of inferred rather than blatant. But we do know that in Paris, he sort of railed to his friend Lady Shelley about the licentiousness of the press, because he'd been attacked about his private affairs, and that was particularly to do with Lady Frances Wedderburn Webster. There was a bit of a scandal about her, and he was outraged that this was reported in the press. I would say that there are sort of two phases to this, because we've got to remember that he was also a revered national figure. So not too many people took pot shots at him at this time. But when he became a political figure, he was thought to be a little bit more of a fair game. But often the criticism against him came in form of like satirical cartoons, which were really popular at the time. So he often appears in those. Of course, his own person and the way he looked, you know, with this very hooked nose, was exaggerated in cartoons. And there are a couple of cartoons that have him and women in them, but they're often have political overtones. So he was fairly ridiculed, like a lot of politicians, in those cartoons. But I think that a lot of people in the press were quite careful about not deriding him too much, because he had this quite special status through most of his life, really, as the sort of victor of Waterloo and the Grand Old Duke of Wellington. But that probably didn't apply just after Waterloo. But that was a particular time. So I think that there was reporting, there was gossip columns, of course there were. And he was very aware that these women, you know, around him, there was gossip. On a couple of occasions, women that he knew had received anonymous letters, sort of not threatening them, but sort of saying, we know about your affair. Mrs. Arbuthnot received one of those. Lady Salisbury, a great friend of his, received an anonymous letter. And after that, he was a little bit more careful. He did write to her and say at one point to Lady Salisbury, don't come and visit me at Walmer Castle by yourself, because he was aware that people were gossiping. So he was careful, because there was gossip, definitely.
We touched on the letter writing at the start of the podcast. Let's get into that a bit more. He had regular correspondence with a number of influential women. Does any of the language in the letters suggest romantic interest?
No, not really. I mean, when he first met Harriet Arbuthnot, she was married to Charles Arbuthnot, a politician who Wellington knew, and the three of them had a very close friendship. When he first met her, some of the letters do say things like, I missed you at such and such a party, and I was so sorry not to see you, and I do look forward to seeing you again. And I suppose they could have had slight sort of romantic connotations, but generally, no, the letters are remarkably unromantic. They're very gossipy. He talks at length about politics. Even reading Harriet's journal, she doesn't say anything romantic about the Duke at all. She admires him above anybody apart from her husband, but not in a romantic sense. And many of these letters are filled with the political gossip of the day. They're a great source of political gossip. And also another point, which people often don't know about the Duke of Wellington, was that he was really interested in his women friends and their family and their children. He has a great interest in their children. With someone like Lady Salisbury, he inquires after the children. She writes in her own journal about his fondness for her children. So the letters aren't romantic. If somebody's reading those letters to try and find romance, then it's not there. As I say, the thing is, we have to remember as well that the Duke was quite keen at destroying a lot of his personal correspondence. So some of his personal correspondence we don't know about, and perhaps there was personal correspondence which was a bit more romantic, but of the surviving correspondence between him and women that he knew, no, there doesn't seem to be anything romantic there.
It all comes down to evidence, really, and there seems to be a bit of a lack of it, especially on the romantic side. Let's move on to what happens in his later years. Now, you told us about when Kitty died. When was that?
1831 that Kitty died. She dies at Apsley House. And Harriet Arbuthnot, who had really been his closest friend, and quite an extraordinary woman in some ways, because she was just so fascinated by politics, and she was completely enamoured with the idea of being close to Wellington because he was such an important man. She dies in 1834, and then Lady Salisbury, again another great friend, dies in 1838. So the 1830s are a time where he loses a lot of his really good friends. Harriet's never really replaced, to be honest, and it's very sad, but her husband, Charles Arbuthnot, who was a lot older than her, he's a very sad widower, and he eventually comes to live with Wellington at Apsley House. I don't think for a moment that he would have come to live with Wellington if Wellington had been Harriet's lover. That just wouldn't have happened. And then as he goes into the sort of late 30s and 40s, there are always women that he's friends with. Lady Wilton is another lady that he writes to a lot. And she doesn't quite replace Harriet, but a lot of their letters are about politics. Mary Jervis is another one. She's a bit more on the social scene because she is a great singer. She's referred to as the siren. Wellington loves music, holds musical evenings, goes to opera. There's quite a lot of gossip about that. Would he marry her? He never intends to at all. Despite his sort of declining years, you know, he gets older, he gets very deaf, which kind of cuts him off a little bit socially because he finds big social gatherings quite difficult because of his deafness. But I suppose that when you look back at the 1820s, there is a whole mix of these women. And we've talked about Harriet Arbuthnot, we've talked about Lady Salisbury. There's also another woman which I do want to talk about, and that's Marianne Patterson. And she is a very beautiful young American heiress who comes over to England with her sisters in the early part of the 19th century. And Wellington is great friends with her and her sisters, and he's completely smitten with Marianne. And for once, there was, I think, justified rumours about her and Wellington, because he was quite blatant in his flirtation with her. And he commissions that very famous portrait of himself by Sir Thomas Lawrence with the red jacket, the Field Marshal's uniform that hangs at Apsley House today. He commissions that painting for her. That was like a token from him to her. And at the same time, he asks Sir Thomas Lawrence to paint her portrait, which he hangs at Stratfield Say. He is smitten with that woman, definitely. If there was one woman you would have thought that he might have wanted to marry, I think it would have been Marianne. Unfortunately, what happens is that she's widowed and then later marries his eldest brother, Richard, which is he's quite distraught about. But a lot of recent work about her, and there's a whole book about her and her sisters, really proves that they didn't have a sexual relationship, however flirtatious it might have been.
How old was the Duke at this time when he was interested in Marianne?
Well, he was in his late 40s, into his 50s.
And this was before Kitty died?
Before Kitty died, because Kitty knew Marianne and her sisters, yeah. So she was definitely on the scene, you know, after Waterloo. He takes her and her sisters on a tour of the battlefield at Waterloo. One of her sisters gets married at Apsley House. He's very close to all the sisters, but he's quite smitten by her, definitely. So I think there were moments, but the thing to remember about Wellington, that he was very conservative, and there was never any moment at which he thought about getting divorced. I mean, divorce was difficult, complicated, and he would never have contemplated divorcing the Duchess.
As he entered his later years, did he have any more relationships? But I understand that there was a young woman who was on the scene at one stage, a ridiculous age gap.
Well, there was, and the one last romantic attack, I always think, was mounted by Angela Burdett Coutts. She was a very wealthy young heiress from the Coutts Bank family. She was obsessed with the Duke. I mean, she was 25 when she first met him and he was already 70. He found her very sweet and interesting and endearing and really valued their friendship. She came to stay with him at Stratfield Say, which was a bit scandalous, really. And he even had part of the house sort of changed, so she had access to his sort of private rooms, which must have caused a little bit of gossip at the time. But they were from very different backgrounds, which is quite interesting. And also from very different worlds, not only sort of social backgrounds. They didn't really know each other socially, although Wellington had known her father, Francis Burdett. But nevertheless, he was nearly 80 and she proposed to him. And he was very flattered, but he didn't think for a moment that he would ever marry her. You know, and he actually said to her that, you know, he would entreat her not to throw herself away upon a man old enough to be her grandfather. She wasn't easily put off. But also, by the time that happened, he was very much of another world, you know, a sort of regency world that had gone. And she was a young woman forging ahead in the Victorian age. You know, you could do another podcast about Angela Burdett Coutts. She's a really interesting philanthropic woman who ends up having a great friendship with Charles Dickens, you know, after Wellington dies. So, you know, she was a really interesting character, but I think she was the sort of last one. I mean, I think the women that were most important to him in his later years were family women. His daughter-in-law, Lady Douro, he was incredibly fond of her. The women that were in his family were, I suppose, significant. And, you know, his growing band of grandchildren, you know, were also important to him. He'd like to surround himself with children. So I don't think that there was any serious thought that he would remarry after Kitty died.
Okay, so we've looked at all the evidence then about the Duke's relationships, marital and potentially extramarital, physical and platonic. How would you sum up his exploits, shall we say, with the opposite sex over his lifetime?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting because I think that this idea that he had these platonic relationships is really a fascinating subject. Of course, Wellington was a famous character, so we know quite a lot about him, but there probably were other men, probably plenty of men who had friendships with women. One of the things we have to keep in mind, and it's a feature of Wellington's female friends, was their political uniformity. They were all from his social and political class. They were all Tories. They all shared his ideals. Even Harriet Arbuthnot, who we could say was slightly more radical, as it were, slightly, you know, was seen to have an unhealthy interest in politics. In fact, her whole outlook was very conservative in so many ways. So they were all socially conservative. They weren't blue stockings. They weren't forward-thinking female thinkers. They didn't write anything publicly. They were women who stick to the order of the day. Their lives were in the private sphere. The men they knew were in the public sphere. That was the divide. So I think that his friendships with those women must have been fulfilling some kind of need that he had, because there were so many of them and they went on for so long. So what was he seeking from those women? I think that, you know, he sought friendship from those women and he happened to find women that he could open up to. I think those friendships tell us a lot about what he wanted from life, which I think was a perfect domestic life. I don't think he wanted to encourage any kind of radical female friendship. I don't think the Duke had one feminist bone in his body. And in fact, the one sort of stridently intellectual woman that he did correspond with in Paris, Madame de Staël, he always said about her that, you know, she was fine as long as you didn't get her onto politics, just kept a conversation light. So I think these women fulfilled a great need that perhaps lacked in his marriage. I think they tell us a lot about the friendships between men and women of that period. Even though they're all of a very kind of high status, it's really interesting to see their interaction, what they thought about, the friendships that they developed, the kind of things that they did together, you know, and this incessant letter writing, which, you know, of course, leaves us with a great legacy to delve through. But of course, a lot of this would have been written for the private. I mean, you know, Mrs. Arbuthnot, I'm sure, never committed anything to a journal thinking that anybody in 2020 would be sitting down to read her journal. So it tells us so much, not just about the Duke, but about the kind of relationships that men and women were having at the time.
And do you think those relationships went against societal norms at that time, or do you think they were more reflective of what was really going on?
I think they were reflective to a certain extent. And I think that Wellington, I don't think, was unusual in having relationships with women. But I think because of his position and who he was, we can't get over the fact that a lot of these women were fairly adoring. But also because he was the kind of man of the moment when they all met him after Waterloo and they wanted to have this friendship with him. But I think it went beyond that, and quickly they realised that they actually liked him. They shared his ideals, they enjoyed his company, because he was good company for his friends. I mean, he was a very sociable, entertaining, caring kind of friend. And I think that it shows also for us another side of the Duke of Wellington, rather than just that rather formal military figure who often feels quite aloof and quite calculating. It shows us that he had another side that was completely different. And he was quite a romantic at heart, I think.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. To learn more about the Duke of Wellington and the Wellington Collection at Apsley House, visit the English Heritage website. Next week, we mark 150 years since the death of the author Charles Dickens and discover the story of the blue plaque at his former London home.
The key thing about it is the wreath. I like that because it really emphasises the award of a plaque. It's really indicating approval using this kind of classical motif.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.